Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
Let Tamsin and Dan read the paper again.
I'm just looking. Your earrings match your sweater.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it's you don't get a lot of
these
that.
These were a gift.
Really? Yeah. Recent?
No.
Can I ask who it's from, or is that a secret?
Yeah, I think it was from Zeke or Noel. Or something,
really?
Years ago.
Well, let's hope so, yeah.
Anyway, here we are. It's April.
I threw you off, huh?
April. April the 7th.
April the 7th, that's right.
Made it through Easter.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. We skipped a podcast, so.
Well, we stretched it out. We've been inundated with the family obligations, and let's face it, we've been watching these children.
And maladies.
I haven't spoken to a person over 3 years old for a long time.
Right.
I'm working on it.
3 year olds come over, you get sick.
Yeah, and the 2 year olds, and the 10 month olds.
Yeah.
Not to mention the 2 month old. I mean, it's we're inundated with
many good adventures.
Yes.
And, especially Easter related.
Mm-hmm.
Egg hunts and so forth.
Yeah. I agree.
So, now everybody is back into their cubby.
Don't say that, because when we go swimming with Hazi, sometimes he does climb into a cubby.
He does.
It's one of his riotous things. So we won't find him. It's fantastic. But, Yeah, so...
It's been an exciting time. It's a little chilly today. It was really warm before we had company. Once we got company... It was cold and rainy
and rough
and awful. But now the weather is working its way back.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. But meanwhile, we had a big excitement yesterday. Right. We had an earthquake.
Yeah.
The earth moved.
You and I are standing in the same room and we hear and feel this rumbling. And I turned to you. I said, what's that? It wasn't that scary. It's just like, what is that? Like a big truck? Or what is that? And I think I said to you, because I'm always on top of these things, well, look, I know it's not an earthquake, so what is it?
Exactly.
And it was an earthquake.
And so it was about, I don't know, 20-some miles from here.
4.8 on the Richter scale.
Yeah.
Look, I don't know what they
Which did. I know.
They're waving it off like no big deal.
Loyal listeners in California find that laughable.
Really? Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, 4.8 on the Richter scale
was
a big deal.
Yeah.
It was a different time. But apparently it's nothing now. Nothing. It barely made the newspapers the next day. It's kind of scary. I don't know what happened.
Well, it was funny because we immediately went to our phones. There was nothing on the phones.
No, there was nothing.
Apparently there was plenty on social media, but that's
we don't
we,
you know.
We roll.
That's not so
but I said to you, if Donald Trump so much as sneezes, I get 3 messages from the New York Times. New York Times said nothing to
me. New York Times was not excited about it.
Very disappointing.
Yeah, so
but it was an extraordinary noise.
Granger called, so otherwise you would have never known. Yeah.
But it was fun to hear it because it was just so otherworldly. You know, it was something different before.
But again, I'm pretty confident you reacted the same way I did. Like, yeah, that's kind of interesting. What's that? And now we heard some of our friends that, you know, Lisa was telling us that she was in some meeting or something or in some building and people were running out of the building. I mean, we didn't have that experience. This is a pretty solidly built
house. No one was running out of this building.
This is a pretty solidly built house, and I think that's part of it.
You know, even so, bad things could happen.
It could happen.
Wasn't that?
But we didn't feel it, is what I'm saying. We didn't feel it that much.
And we didn't see anything. You know, people talk about their chandeliers swinging or whatever.
No, nothing like that.
We didn't see anything like that.
No.
We were in the hallway with no chandeliers. So.
No.
There you have it.
Yeah, the day before it was a windy day and there were trees coming down like nobody's business. That was something else.
The night before was actually very scary.
Yeah.
But,
an earthquake. Not an earthquake. And you know, not to be outdone. Mother Nature is planning tomorrow an eclipse.
Right.
An eclipse. I mean, this is like the end of days. First, you have the windstorm, you know, the so-called Northeaster. Then you have the earthquake. And now an eclipse.
Northeaster.
Well, I'm from the Northeast.
Northeaster.
I'd like to be technically correct. And now the eclipse, it's like 3 things in a week. I mean, my God. So, Granger and Nico gave us a set of these eclipse glasses. And I'm very skeptical about this because it says if you use these glasses, you can stare into the sun during the eclipse. And I'm saying to myself, what's the percentage in that? I mean, why would anyone take a chance on that?
Well, you want to see what it looks like.
Surely someone will take a photograph and I'll be able to see it. You know, do I have to do that?
I feel sure when we were young, we just stared right at eclipses.
We did. It was a different time. And you know, we weren't wearing seatbelts when we did it too. That's the other funny
That's
thing.
True.
But I looked this up, and it does look like, it looks like the side of a Cracker Jack box. But you get on the internet, and this is called Lunt Solar Systems. And, it's a legit thing. First of all, it looks like it was made for took 20 cents to manufacture, but it looks like Granger must have paid like $5 for each of these. And it has the right magic number on it. There's a serial number it has to have.
Yeah.
It has that number.
Okay.
And,
Heard on the, also on the news program that was telling you what the right number is.
Yeah.
Also said, but some fake glasses are printed with that number.
Well, right. Well, so listen, you get on the web.
Let's not go heavily at this.
No, but
funny. It's not interesting.
My point is, you look it up and it's like $5, but then of course, Amazon being Amazon, you keep looking. They got ones that you can get, 20 cents a piece. Boom, boom, boom. You may even wonder about
that. Who knows?
Who knows? So, and
but you know what you got to do.
What?
You got to keep looking until you find the ones that are $20 a piece.
Well, this was $5. This is right?
so this is in that sweet spot.
Then
you know it works.
Sweet spot, yeah. And I'm saying to myself, how do I feel about this? And I'm looking at the articles in the Times, and they swoosh. Of course, as you'd expect, they have an article in the opinion section and in the news section. And in the Times now, the opinion section and the news section are kind of the same. And each of the articles says, this is life-changing. The eclipse will be the biggest thing that happens in your lifetime. And I read both those articles, and now I'm convinced it's kind of a real nothing burger, honestly. These are people who I could not have a conversation with.
Well, my mother said she's concerned about whether all the old wives' tales are true.
Yeah, well,
and I said, like, which ones?
You know?
She said, I don't know.
Yeah, your mother.
And then she said, the milk going sour.
Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye on that. I mean, look, your mother's 97. If anyone's concerned about old wives' tales...
No, she's 98.
98?
She's about to be 99.
God. If anyone's concerned about old wives' tales, it's your mother. If she's not concerned about it, no one's going to care about the old wives' tales. She's here for those old wives' tales to be passed on. So
but
good for her.
She should have a better handle on them.
If given time, you could work with her. I think you could come up with it. I think the sour milk thing's a thing. That's not the first time I've heard that. That's why I invented Fairlife, because the old wives' tales. Anytime there's an eclipse,
right.
It goes. Fairlife doesn't go
next eclipse.
Exactly, that's the way they're selling that. All right, so that's a lot to look forward to tomorrow. We'll see. It goes on for hours. I think it goes on like 2 to 4 o'clock.
Well, how long do you think it takes the moon to move into position?
My understanding was those things move very fast, but apparently not. Apparently,
it depends on your point of view.
When I was a kid,
it's all relative.
When I was a kid, they moved much faster. All right, so we also saw a film this week, because that's the kind of people we are.
Yeah, so, for 3 weeks, we had not been, in front of the screen too much.
Right.
Except for the exception of basketball.
And watching Bluey.
And Bluey.
We've seen a lot of, we could talk about Bluey for quite some time.
And I'm now pretty much an expert on Frozen 2, although I still haven't seen Frozen 1.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think
I can just
My understanding is you can understand Frozen 2 even if you don't see Frozen 1. That's what I've been told.
Yeah.
And Bluey, I noticed you're starting to talk with an Australian accent. So I know you've been watching a lot of Bluey. The Last Repair Shop was nominated for and won an Oscar for Best Documentary Short Film. And we had heard about it. So we saw it. And the story is this. Los Angeles is one of the few United States cities that offers to provide and to fix musical instruments for public school students. And as a result, the city owns 80,000 musical instruments that it has to maintain for these students. And there is a singular shop in downtown Los Angeles, a huge warehouse that focuses on repairing these musical instruments for these kids as they get into disrepair during their use. And the documentary was about folks, a few folks who work in that shop and a few of the students who have their instruments repaired and talk about, how excited they are about being able to play these instruments. But that's a very superficial discussion of what it's about. But there's a lot more going on. So I'll stop there. So what
Good.
Did you...
Well, the point is, if I even read about exactly what was the format, I would not have been interested in seeing it properly. It sounds pretty...
mundane.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yet it was excellent.
Yeah.
It was great. The people they chose to interview were interesting, compelling, funny, had good stories.
And the kids were very engaging.
The kids were wonderfully engaging. At the end, I'm always ready to turn off the credits. At the end, the credits was really actually focused on a concert.
They had a performance.
By alumni of the program.
Right.
And it was wonderful. Mm. And you saw people that you had seen talking, and you saw some of the repair people working on it. And there were literally stories from all over the world coming into play. But that, it was just very interesting, moving, enjoyable to watch.
Yeah.
So it makes you want to go out and get a job like that.
Yeah, it was very meaningful. Very meaningful.
Something that you're confident about, that you're working hard, that does some good.
Well,
something to
but you know what, Megan, it was more to it than that, because certain of the interviews, and only interviewed four or five people who repair people, and some of them, the focus was clearly they're doing some, one or two were actual musicians, and they're, paying it back, paying it forward, whatever you want to call it, and helping these students out, because the musical instruments mean so much to these kids. But there was at least one story about a woman for whom it was in a very significant career, that she, had a hard time surviving economically. And she managed to qualify to get this job, much to her amazement.
Yeah.
And she was able to provide differently for her children.
It was a real bootstraps thing.
Right. So it's a totally different kind of story.
Got a job at a music store.
Right. She could have gotten a job as a dental assistant or something like that. But it was about her climbing up the economic ladder.
And working hard to develop this skill.
Yeah.
And excel in it.
Yeah.
So, like I said, heartwarming, touching, life-affirming, and not in a cliched, mundane way at all.
Right.
So highly recommend it. It's only 40 minutes. It's not going to make
short.
A big dent.
It's a short. Won the Academy Award.
Yeah. Last repair.
Right. So you had another story about violins.
Speaking of musicians and technicians, there was a story in the New York Times under their heading Art of the Craft, and about a young woman, A Young An, who grew up in South Korea and is now a violin maker in Cremona, Italy. And it's a really nice story, and also accompanied with online really nice pictures of her workshop, her work, etc. And she got her first violin when she was 8.
Mm-hmm.
And she liked it so much she slept with it.
Oh, boy.
And when she was 10, a violin shop opened up in town.
Mm-hmm.
And she was obsessed with it.
This is in Korea.
In Korea.
Yeah,
South Korea. And by the time she's 17, she has a plan. Well, she decides at some point, she's as a teenager, that she wants to make violins.
Right.
And she has a plan to go to Chicago, live with an American family, and go to an institute that's famous for making stringed instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and her parents don't want her to do it.
Yeah.
And she goes on like a hunger strike.
Are you
kidding? And finally, they agree to it.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, when she, goes off to get on the plane, they're crying. She was not.
Mm-hmm.
This was her plan. She was excited. She was moving forward. She starts in that program, and she realizes that really the place to be is Cremona. And by the time she's 20, she's in Cremona. And now she's in her 30s, and she's got a workshop. And she shares the workshop with her husband, who is also a violin maker.
Mm.
And
Italian?
I don't know if he's Italian. He had seemed his name is Wang Su Han.
Okay.
So
not Italian.
Not well. He may be Italian. Just says,
no.
Okay. Takes she says about 2 months to make a violin.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she could do it in a shorter time, but she doesn't want to do it in a shorter time.
Mm-hmm.
You lose things. And they sell for around $17,000 to $18,000.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she literally spends every minute of the 2 months mm-hmm. on one instrument at a time. Because mm-hmm. even she wouldn't even be able to live in Cremona probably right. at that rate. But that's that she works very hard to make the instruments look old. Like a Stradivarius. Mm-hmm. It's not that she's forging an ancient instrument. There, mm-hmm. you know, she has her own label and brand mm-hmm. Burned into the thing, etc. And she's, you know, very proud of her work. But she is very traditional, and she wants the traditional look, the traditional sound. So it was interesting. I put it up there with the, last week or the week before, we were talking about the gold beater in Venice. You know, it's one of those small arts.
Quite
fascinating. Mm-hmm. You know, interesting things. You know, Italy's a mess, but interesting things are still happening there, including food.
I agree.
Italy, yeah.
Yeah, look, she must make like 15, 20 a year or something like that. And, you know, probably makes a decent living doing that. So,
well, I hope she makes a decent living. You know, she's got all kinds of stuff. She's got, you know, adhesives, different kinds of materials to rough up the edges. She scratches them with pieces of pasta. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so talk about things that are both a combination of art and science. We go to the NFL. And the NFL draft is coming up. And I say art and science because... the science is there's so much data about all these potential draft picks. And there's so much watching of film. I mean, you can't imagine all the brain
stuff. And analyzing of data, right?
It's unbelievable analysis.
They've all got all these statistics.
Right. It's crazy.
And what's the one that really matters for alignment?
It turns out that what really matters when you're drafting a lineman is the size of the guy's butt. That's what the New York Times said. Yeah, well, it is the New York Times. And
first of all, let me say, this is a great article.
Yeah.
This is from the Athletic.
Athletic, right? Which is owned by the Times, yes.
And it's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's so much fun to hear men talking about...
They have all these phrases, all these euphemisms for butt.
Right.
They have Colt or the caboose. It goes on and on and on.
But also the ones for no butt.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah, flat butt. Yeah, so,
taking no ass at all pills.
Hmm.
Saggy pants. Apparently these scouts will look at somebody and know immediately whether they feel... They have explosive power.
Right.
And that is told to you by the behind.
Yes. Like
I said, it's very much fun to hear men objectify body parts of another guy, not a woman. And, it doesn't sound like sex has much to do with it at all.
No, they're looking for the, quote, the biggest ass defensive lineman they can find. They showed an example. Bill Belichick. He's watching a bunch of guys line up to do a 40-yard sprint or something. And they notice that Belichick is not standing at the finish line with a stopwatch. He's standing at the beginning. So he's effectively behind the guys running. And they're running. And someone says to Belichick, what are you doing that for? You're in the wrong place. So Belichick's best buddy, as some people know, is Nick Saban, who's the coach of Alabama, who's standing next to him. And he explained. He says, don't want to see these guys' butts. I mean, if you look at it, he wants the guy with the biggest ass guys. That's the guy he wants playing lineman for him. That's what it's all about. And the science is, there is science. We have a Dr. Alexandra Lemke, an assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth, explains that in a broad sense, muscle hypertrophy, which is size, relates to muscle strength. A larger muscle indicates higher ability to produce force. So when you think of sprinting and explosive movements, that's primarily driven from the glutei maximus to give that explosive first step. So they're not kidding. They want a guy with a big butt. And as you say, there are all kinds of euphemisms they use.
They talk about the caboose correlation.
The caboose correlation. What was the HBP thing? I'm looking at
HBF.
HBF, which is the high butt factor.
Yes.
So they so in the written evaluations they say HBF.
That's the high butt factor.
And if on the other hand, if a guy says, you know, it's a flat ass guy, forget him. He says they won't even draft a guy with a flat ass.
They will say can't anchor. Don't need to watch any tape just by looking at the guy. Can't anchor.
Yeah.
And this he has a small butt.
Right. And it even goes to punters. They tell a story about Andy Reid, the coach of the Kansas City team, who's talking to the punter at one point. He says, look, you had a good year, but I notice your ass is getting a little flat. You can't have a flat ass as a punter, you know. Do working out in the offseason and get back there.
Well, here's the thing I sort of didn't understand.
Yeah.
At the end, near the end, there's like a, you know, sort of a rhapsody or a diatribe or something about, you know, the idea that another thing a big butt tells you is this is someone who works really hard in the gym.
Right.
And there's a real value to that, who's somebody working hard
right.
to be, you know, for the team,
mm-hmm.
to be a great player, et cetera. I mean, lots of people can work hard, and lots of people can have a big butt. Doesn't mean they're going to be a great player.
Just one fact. But it shows, they said, no pun intended, it shows that you've got a guy who works his ass off, which is sort of...
Or works his ass on.
Right? Works his ass on. Yeah. Look, any event.
Anyway, this is what I say.
Yeah.
Find the article.
Yeah.
Because it's in the New York Times or The Athletic.
Well, we can't do it justice, but it's a hysterically funny article.
It's really fun to read. It's a long, funny article with quotes from all kinds of, you know, grizzly old guys talking about.
And said, yeah, they want to see the guy's butt. I mean, in all kinds of stories. The two guys standing at the scouting combine saying, watch, this guy's going to do great in the sprints. Watch, this guy's going to do great in the broad jump. Why? Huge butt. And they're always right. So there you go. That's all you need to look at. I hope the Giants are listening to the podcast. Maybe they can use some offensive line. That's all I can say. All right. So John Barth passed away. So John Barth
is... Are you cutting me out here?
Do you have something? Oh, you do? I'm not cutting you out. Talk about the museum heist first. Then I'll talk about John Barth.
Well, this is just very weird. It has too many details for me to even explain it properly.
Yeah.
But there was a series of museum heists.
Yeah.
Mostly in, I guess, the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
I guess over the last 10 or 15 years. 19 years, actually. And at all these small museums were getting... robbed.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Everhart Museum in Scranton, Space Farm Zoo Museum, Ringwood Manor, United Golf Association Museum, National Museum of Racing, the Yogi Berra Museum.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are more. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, turned out there was a kind of a gang of guys doing this. And it's all terrible. It's all awful. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
First of all, they say, you know, it's not like it was some sophisticated group of people. It was more 7-Eleven than Ocean's 11. And
was that line in the article?
Yes,
or was
that line was in the article.
Okay.
Okay. And, it, you know, they estimate that more than $4 million worth of objects were taken. All right. Miscellaneous objects. Some places it was like an Andy Warhol. Mm-hmm. Picture of Jackson Pollock, okay, mm-hmm. but in most places it was these racing trophies.
Mm-hmm.
It was for the Yogi Berra Museum. They took every one of all of his championship rings,
mm-hmm.
except the one he's wearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you know, trophies, United Golf Association trophies, a few other that Tiffany lamp,
mm-hmm.
And what did they do with it? Most of the stuff seems to have been destroyed or, like, melted down. Like, they melted down the trophies for the value of the metal.
Oh, my God.
Well, because things like this, it has a trophy, it has an inscription.
You can't sell.
You can't sell it, right? So it's mystifying. They could have, I guess it's Yogi Berra's daughter or granddaughter, somebody says, you could have gotten more... gold by hitting a few jewelry stores or something. It's all these different places over years, and you know, not with any tremendous skill at all. They're working out of the Poconos. Out of the Poconos, Daniel. Right. And so they finally arrested a few guys. They actually stopped this one guy for bad, you know, kind of, the police stopped a guy for driving, you know, erratically.
Mm-hmm.
And haven't got a hold of his DNA, and it matched up with the DNA from one of these jobs and so on. And that was just a few years ago, like 2019. It's taken all these years to really find it. Oh, they even, they destroyed, they hit the Roger Maris Museum.
I know there was a Roger Maris.
And destroyed his MVP plaque. Melted it down.
I got good news for you, Tamsin. He won the MVP twice. Okay. So maybe they only destroyed one of the two.
All right. Now I feel better. So it's this guy, Thomas Trotta, and his buddy Nicholas Dombeck.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, operating out of like a garage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Trotta, I don't even think graduated from high school or anything. They're not masterminds. Not too slick at all. But, it's just because, I guess because he's, you know, basically little museums.
I smell,
to some small extent, they knew what they were doing.
I smell TV series.
That's what I was going to say next.
Is that right?
The reason to bring this up is, I mean, these guys, there's a lot, first of all, there's a lot of comic potential here.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of creating some series about these guys' operations would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
So keep your eyes open.
Well, Jimmy Breslin wrote a novel years ago called The Gang Who Couldn't Shoot Straight.
Yes, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or even the guy, what was that series we watched, that weird series?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but I don't remember the name of it.
Yeah.
That's some shifty guy, some con man guy.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll keep our eyes open for that. Now, I'll just do this short. This is not that exciting.
The thing.
What?
One more thing about this.
Yeah.
We have a racing trophy.
Yeah.
That I bought.
Yeah.
At a...
we didn't steal it.
An antique shop.
Right.
Who knows?
Who was stolen?
Maybe it came from one of those places.
Okay.
Now I feel bad.
No, you don't. It's silver. I mean, no one's going to steal that to melt it down. John Borth was a novelist. Here's what's interesting to me about John Borth. John, first of all, I have to explain. John Borth was, certainly according to the obituary and according to my vague recollection, a hugely celebrated novelist in the 1970s and 1980s. Hugely celebrated. He was, his most famous book is The Sotweed Factor, and also he wrote Giles' Goat Boy. And The Sotweed Factor, I'll come back to that, but he was on the faculty at the University of Buffalo, which resonates with me. Because he was on the faculty when my brother was at the University of Buffalo.
Right.
And also on the faculty was a leading critic by the name of Leslie Fiedler. So they were considered a pretty high-class English department there. Mr. Fiedler described the Sotweed Factor as, quote, closer to the great American novel than any other book of the last decade. Time magazine called it, quote, that rare literary creation, a genuinely serious comedy. I could read praise and praise and praise. The New York Times reviewer said, for all the vigor of whatever models that this is based on, we have to go back to Rabelais. Is that the right way to pronounce it? Rabelais. To match Sotweed Factor's...
That's how they pronounce it in music band, so I would stick with that.
Okay. Match its unbridled bawdiness and scatological mirth. Right? Yeah, it's supposed to be kind of a picaresque tale like Tom Jones. What interests me about this, well, first of all, a couple of things. Number one, two things about Buffalo when my brother was there. One is you had Leslie Fiedler and John Borth. Two is there was a lot of student protest, which is strangely described in John Barth's obituary. They refer to the student upheaval in early 1970, and now Borth really had no interest in it. And Borth volunteered laconically that what he learned was, quote, the fact that the situation is desperate doesn't make it any more interesting, which is a funny comment, because I well remember what was going on, my brother's involvement in it, but that's just me and my brother. Sotweed Factor was one of those books, so, you know, I got the calls a few years after Bob, and it was a sign. It was one, you know, took one of these survey courses in Great American Novels, Salt Weed Factor. All of Barth's books were long, 500 pages. Probably didn't have time to read it very carefully. I read it at all. I think I read it fast. Didn't get anything out of it. So, you know, you reach a point in life and you say, you know, that book might have been okay. It didn't give it the kind of script it was entitled to. I should pick another look. I went to buy it a couple years ago. First of all, it's hard to even find. It's almost like out of print, which is weird. And then I got it, and I spent some time with it, and I'm still saying I'm still getting nothing out of this book. And I think you told me you tried to read it.
Well, I will be the first to say it's way above my pay grade.
No, no, no. It's not above anything.
I just didn't get it. I tried to read it a couple times.
It's a bawdy costume romance. It's right up your alley.
No, it didn't strike me that way at all, I must say. So I have nothing interesting to add to this.
I have to go back to it a third time now. Because I'm missing something, or I don't know what's going on. But it is interesting to me that, I'm telling you, Barth was a huge deal in the early 70s. And, we'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who knows who he is at this point. He has one interesting quote. An interviewer asked John Barth if he read his reviews, and here's the quote. He says, "Sure. As used to tell my apprentices, what you want most is intelligent praise. If you can't have intelligent praise, you'll take stupid praise. If you can't have stupid praise, the third best thing is intelligent criticism. And of course, the worst thing is stupid criticism." So we learned something from that. Okay, let's move ahead. So here's something that struck me. And I think, was it Zeke or Granger who pointed this out to me? I think it was Zeke. Yes, it was definitely Zeke. That there is an X-Men series, a new X-Men series on Disney, which is called X-Men 97. And the concept is startling. When you look at it, it looks like, you know, a cartoon, a hand-drawn cartoon series from 20, 25 years ago. And it turns out that's what it is. That there was, and I vaguely remember the kids watching.
No, that's what they wanted to look like.
Yeah, well,
but it's not hand drawn.
I will walk through. I don't know if it's not hand drawn. I don't know. I mean, there was a series from 1992 to 1997 called X-Men that the kids used to watch, and of course, looking over their shoulder, I would see once in a while, and I certainly know X-Men comics. And now they have just picked it up as if it was 1998. And, you know, with succeeding episodes, with the thought that they're trying to match it so it has the same look and feel and sound and technical aspects of the series that ended in 1997. I mean, so much so, the article in the Times starts by a reference to a voice actor by the name of Allison Steele Smith, who was the voice of Storm. In 1997, she got a call asking if she wants to continue voicing Storm in the X-Men series. She thought it was a practical joke.
The original Storm.
But that's not my point. The point is she thought it was a practical joke. I did that 25 years ago. What are you talking about? That series is over.
Right. Okay. So what do you know about it? Has anybody said it's,
I've
is
looked
it any
at
good?
It. It was good. It's excellent for the kind of thing it is.
All right.
But they said emulating the look and feel of a 30-year-old animated series.
We got that.
It was much harder.
Moving along here.
Much harder. The original show was hand-drawn, and to achieve that look,
with a computer,
the new team had to put technical limitations on itself, restricting the kinds of flourishes that are easy with computers. Right? They had to make it look almost like it was a VHS print or something like that. All right. You obviously don't appreciate this. Well, watch it tonight. You'll come around.
Look, you can watch that after you watch some of your Bosch shows.
Oh, boy. Bosch. Maybe I'll watch some Bosch tonight. You know that Bosch?
I think it's fine, Daniel, that, you know, we each have books we read for ourselves. You can have some.
You can read a little John Barth
TV
tonight, and then some Bosch, and then some X-Men. You've got my whole evening planned out. All right, so finally, a lot of articles about the passing of Daniel Kahneman. Or as he was known as Danny Kahneman, as a matter of fact, who was an Israeli-born behavioral economist. You know, the field didn't exist before him. He was an economist, he was a psychologist, and he became a so-called behavioral economist. And famously, his most famous book was Thinking Fast and Slow. And Thinking Fast and Slow Did you read Thinking Fast and Slow? I don't remember.
No, but you were very excited about it.
I was excited about reading it. But I was reading, look, Thinking Fast and Slow really comes down to two things, saying there's two different mental processes. Mm-hmm. One is fast and one is slow. One is considered, you know, based on heuristics or experience or muscle memory. You have an immediate intuitive reaction to something. The answer must be blank. The proper response must be blank.
Right.
And according to Kahneman, there's a completely different process is slow thinking, which is more logical, which the mind takes a step back and works through all the logical aspects. And there are two different processes. And that was considered a
revelation.
Sensation. Oh, yeah.
Which was he promoting?
He wasn't, well, I think he's really promoting slow.
Right.
Okay. Because a lot of what he's doing at the end of the day is pointing out the lack of logic in a lot of decisions that are made, because they're done on the muscle memory, intuitive hunch approach, which is thinking fast. And he's talking about how, therefore, people make illogical decisions. First of all, the book is 300 pages. I read the first 80 pages. I had the whole thing. Okay?
Yeah.
It's not that complicated. Secondly.
Well, you skipped kindergarten.
It's true. It's true.
So that, yeah.
I'm a gifted individual. Yeah. Secondly, I'm not even sure that all this is right. His big example was, you know, people really, they're not logical. They worry about losing $100 and are hurt much more by losing $100 than they are benefited or joyful about getting an extra $100. Not logical. And I'm saying, mm-hmm. No, it is logical, because the marginal utility of funds diminishes the more you have. If, you know, your first $100 means a lot more to you than your next $100. So I don't find that terribly illogical.
Mm-hmm.
It's an odd thing reading about Kahneman, because there are all these people who are testing. He's a genius, genius, genius. And every article I've read, I've now read four or five articles about his passing and his work, and none of them have anything that strikes me as a revelation worth talking about. And the one in the journal, the long article, says he really opened this guy's eyes about investing. And I was interested in that. I said, okay, so what kind of insights do I get from Kahneman about investing? And the answer is none. The only thing he does say is that, you know, people shouldn't try to outsmart the market. And Kahneman says, quote, "I don't try to be clever at all. Most of my money was in index funds. The idea that I could outsmart the market based on all the information that's available is an illusion." Well, I'm not blowing my own horn, but I think me and millions of other people figured that out 25, 30 years ago. You know, no Nobel Prize for me. Kahneman won the Nobel Prize. Kahneman says, quote, "All of us would be better investors if we just made fewer decisions, otherwise known as buy and hold," which is, you know, anyway.
All right.
I don't get it. I don't even know why I'm talking about it, but I am talking about it because maybe some people write in and explain Kahneman to me. But anyway, we're running out of time. That's it.
We're not running out of time.
We're running out of time.
We're running out of material.
Now, both. And the good news is the Mets won today. And
so you're in a good mood.
And there's an eclipse tomorrow.
And we're going to have an eclipse tomorrow.
The Mets win about every time that there's a full eclipse, the Mets win. That's the way that
So here's what I learned by having all these children and grandchildren visiting.
What?
At any given moment, if you think you've figured something out about your children or your grandchildren, you'll find out you're wrong.
That
doesn't
sounds
matter
like,
what it is.
Sounds like what Daniel Kahneman would
doesn't
say.
Doesn't matter if it's like
you want to give
somebody's favorite is Cheerios or not. You know. Just be ready to roll with the punches.
You want to give a specific example?
No. I'm just saying.
It is that, funny. I have to say.
You're expecting things to happen, and you prepare yourself a certain way, and you prepare these things, and maybe you go out and buy this food or set this up.
Well, you can't know.
And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's wrong.
I will say.
So that they will constantly surprise you, mostly in good ways.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's, you know, Hossie's inscrutable. Hossie's favorite thing is to say, "Hossie, do you know the way this works?" And he'll say, "Yes." And I'll say, "How does it work?" And he goes, "I don't know." So that's his standard thing. But I think it's funny, you know, when you talk to Pepper and you're talking, you're watching Frozen and you say something about Anna and Enya. And Pepper turns to you and says, It's Anna.
Anna, Anna. Elsa.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Anna and Elsa. Anna, yes. not Anya. Anna, not Anna. Yeah. Yeah. So they keep you on your toes. That's for sure. Right?
Back to the drawing board.
Back to the drawing board. Did I mention I like the earrings?
This is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
Tamsin and Dan read the paper.
We'll see you.